Now it's time to introduce the speaker. I've known Jim for, oh God, it's gonna be half hour now. And I've seen him around campus though, and I used to work here and years ago, but I remember whenever there was a code, you know, you have to go running. I saw Jim all the time. So, but he's, I know he works at the evening IOP. He's a former Delta pilot, and I know he has 31 years of sobriety, but other than that, he can tell you the rest. So I'm giving it it's my honor to introduce Jim.
Don't get mad at him.
I'm not getting mad. Don't get mad, get even, right? Can you hear me okay in the back? Can you hear me okay in the front, on the sides? I'm Jim, I'm an alcoholic. In fact, I'm Jim Green and I'm an alcoholic. And I like to introduce myself with my last name because I'm always frustrated when I'm in a group and somebody says, well, you know, Fred died. And I, you know, well, which one is Fred? You know, well, you know, he's the guy in the purple shirt, the guy who always sits over there in the corner. And Dr. Bob said once, he said, you know, one of the biggest abuses of the principle of anonymity is that we keep our names secret from ourselves. It definitely says in the traditions that we keep our anonymity at the level of press, radio, and television, and film, and all that other stuff. So I like to introduce myself by my whole name, so people kind of, when Jim kicks off, everybody know who that guy is. Oh yeah, he's the guy. Eddie told me to come up here and talk. He wanted me to come up and speak to you because he said he wants to hear a little bit of emphasis on what it's like now. Our stories disclose in a general way what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. And I've got 31 years of what it's like now to talk about. A lot of that 31 years of what it's like now is not very exciting. To be perfectly frank, my drunk log before I got sober is really not very exciting either. Actually, when I was in a treatment center, it wasn't this, it was Anchor Hospital down on the south side. And one of the doctors there used to tell patients, he says, geez, you know, why don't you go out and improve your story a little bit? And I kind of took that personally. I didn't feel like I needed to go out and improve my story or make it more laughable or more interesting or anything else. I couldn't figure out why my story ended up in a treatment for alcohol. It was a mystery to me. So I'm going to go ahead and talk about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I've got, Eddie said 40 minutes, so I'm going to talk till about 20 after the hour, 15 after. And I'll stop whenever the clock hits that mark, or when my notes run out, or when I just draw a total blank about what I'm trying to remember to tell you folks. What it was like. I was born at a very young age, I was an Army brat, still am, I think, at heart, maybe. So I traveled all over the world. I call Seattle, Washington, my home. I was actually born in Berkeley, California. I lived everywhere. Well, I lived a lot of different places, California, Eastern Washington, Central Washington, Georgia, Indiana, Japan, Honduras, Tegucigalpa, Honduras, Fort Benning, Georgia, and Colorado Springs, Colorado, and those are just the ones that pop into my mind. And I had a pretty good life. My dad was a colonel in the Army, so we lived on nice quarters, or at least as nice a quarters as that particular post happened to have, and some posts were much nicer than others. Basically child of an upper middle class military family. went to 12 schools before I graduated from high school, and I'm not sure what that did to me, if that made me good at forming new friends, or if that just made me not very interested in friends or whatever, but I kind of grew up to be a little bit of a loner, and I realized that. I didn't realize, even think of those words in terms of myself until after I got sober. But I just like to do things alone. I like to be around people too. I don't dislike people, and obviously the work I've done here at Ridgeview is always around people, so that turns me on as well. But I do like my solitude, and I will talk maybe a little bit if I have time about what I see as the difference between solitude and isolation. Let's see. I learned late in life that my grandfather was abusive to my mother. And I think my mother has alluded to the fact that he was also possibly had a problem with alcohol. And so, you know, everybody in the family tried to say, oh yeah, well they say this disease is, runs in families, and maybe Jim got it from granddad. I don't know who I got it from, and I'll talk about that too a little bit later. But anyway, moving all over the place, I had a fairly well-rounded, I think, worldview. I knew a lot about international politics as a teenager. I knew a lot about U.S. politics and just how things go around. I graduated from high school. Actually, 2 years of my high school were by correspondence, which I guess suited my isolationism, my solitarism. And I ended up getting back to the States, graduating from high school back in 1959, and went to the UW, University of Washington, for a couple years, then went to West Point. And I spent 4 years at West Point, graduated from there in 1965, and spent 8 years in the military myself. Just quickly to run that down, I had two tours in the Far East, one in Vietnam and one in Korea, back in the late 60s, early 70s. And my drinking was pretty healthy then. By healthy, I mean it was alive and well. It was my major pastime. During both of those overseas tours. In the Army, I got into Army aviation. My basic branch was infantry. Back in the day, they did not have an Army aviation branch. They get to wear little wings with a propeller on them now, and I didn't get that. I was an infantry officer. My primary MOS was infantry small unit leader. And with Vietnam on the horizon, when I got my lieutenant's bars, I thought, you know, I got to do something to get out of the rice paddies, and let me see if I can take on a specialty. So I decided to try to get into Army Flight School, which I succeeded. Graduated from flight school in 1967, and served in, as an Army aviator for the next 6 years, and then a lot of guys in the unit I was serving with here in Atlanta were kind of keen on getting on with the airlines, and I'd never even thought about going with an airline job. My whole purpose in going to West Point was to be an Army officer just like my dad, and that's the only thing I ever thought about doing. But I thought, you know, hey, I've been in the Army for 30 years as a kid and as a soldier. I think I'll try out this civilian life and see what it's like. So I resigned my commission and applied to Delta Airlines and got lucky and got hired by Delta in 1973. And I worked for Delta for 28 years as a pilot. That's just kind of how my life went right up until the time that I got sober. But to go back into my drinking history, my dad drank very moderately. He wasn't a teetotaler, but I seldom saw him have more than a glass of scotch. Scotch and soda, I think, is what he liked, and I didn't like scotch, never did like scotch. Still wouldn't drink scotch if I relapsed. It's just not my drink. But I did like wine and beer. My mom also liked to drink, and I think that's where the gene came down. From my grandfather, perhaps from my mom. But the first time I remember drinking was when I was 14. I went to a party, a Christmas party in Central America, of all places, and my sisters were there, sort of all three of us were there. There was a mixed crowd of people from eighth, ninth graders, like I was, to college students. And my sisters left to go get some more records because they were running short on the records, 33-inch RPM. Y'all remember those. They went to get some more music, and I found the punch. And the punch was, I don't know what was in it, probably vodka and a good bit of fortified wines or whatever. But by the time my sisters got back, I was staggering and acting like a fool. Not the first, it wasn't to be the last time. That was my first drunk. They stuck my head underneath the cold water faucet and sobered me up. My parents never heard a thing about it. And the next time I got drunk that I recall was about four and a half years later. I was a student at the University of Washington. Through my high school years after that, I never drank a thing. When I went to the University of Washington, I joined a fraternity, and I remember one particular party where I'm surprised I didn't have alcohol poisoning. I was pretty darn drunk. And there was another fraternity party, after finals party, with the beer kegs flowing. My problem with drinking was I just didn't know to stop. I didn't have any problem with alcohol. I just didn't know when to stop drinking it. So that's how I didn't think much about those situations until later on when people started telling me that, that I was an alcoholic. And, I'm thinking, well, how could I be an alcoholic? And then so slowly some of the recall came back, including one of the times that when I was at West Point. Well, actually, it wasn't. There were several times at West Point on football trips or something like that that I would have a few too many. But the one thing that stands out in my mind was a bunch of us got married right after graduation day, June 9th, 1965. I got married on June 11th, the Friday of that week. We graduated on Wednesday. We got married. My wife and I got married on the Friday of that week, June 9th. She's still with me, and why she's put up with me all these years, I don't have a clue. All I can do is call it grace. But the reason I mention all that is that Johnny Longhauser, one of my good friends, a retired two-star general, he got married on Thursday of that week, and I was too drunk to attend his wedding, even though I was supposed to stand up for him at the cadet chapel. We had a bachelor party for him the night before, and Jim spent half the night just sleeping out in the yard on the grass. Again, didn't know when to quit. A lot of the years ensued, there was some dangerous drinking. There was some stupid drinking. By dangerous drinking, I'm talking about driving under the influence. And not just driving under the influence or doing stupid things under the influence, but folks, I was under the influence of drugs whether I was drinking or not. I was, my whole value system and my whole life was shaped by my interest in alcohol and when the next drink was going to come. That's just what I did. I drank and partied and had fun or got drunk alone, whatever. So, I've likened my life to a skyscraper. You see the girders go up before they put the facing on it. Somebody takes a giant blowtorch and makes that thing just kind of start, you know, looking like that. And that's what my life looked like. I was just a skyscraper that was about to fall over. My abusive behavior, my reckless behavior when I'm sober was, you know, there was some abusive behavior, just abusive in being verbally intolerant sometimes of people, of judging people, arguing with my wife and being loud. A couple times I recall breaking furniture, which just gives me a lot of shame when I remember that. And just having kind of a temper and always wanting to be right. I was always breaking boundaries, and I had fairly, what I thought were fairly high ethics, high morals, but it was sure easy to break them. What happened? It's time to stop talking about the way it was. Y'all pretty much get that picture. What happened? I was on a trip to Bombay, India, of all places, and the the day, it was a 3-day layover there, and the day before we were to leave, I went out with the captain. I was a co-pilot on the trip, and I went out with the captain, looked at some precious stones I bought from my wife, a few stones from my wife, and the sellers of these gemstones would try to loosen us up with beer. And I drank a couple of beers during the day. And the captain I was with was kind of a teetotaler, I thought, as I understood him. And he didn't drink anything. But not only did I drink in the afternoon, because pickup wasn't until 2 o'clock in the morning, but we went home that night, went back to the hotel. I went out with the British Airways crew, drank some, but all afternoon before I went out with that British Airways crew, I drank some of the worst beer in the world. And I don't know how other Indian beers are, but this stuff was bad. And not only that, but I was drinking it in the hotel lobby, and I was within the 8-hour rule. So I was putting everything on the line and not even thinking about it. Not even thinking about it. And that's another thing that proves to me I was an alcoholic, was that I was drinking that beer in that place at the time. So anyway, the captain didn't say anything to me until later on that night in the wee small hours. We were at 30,000 some odd feet over the Indian Ocean, and the other co-pilot had stepped out for a break. He had started the flight. I was the first officer, and he was the reserve pilot. But the captain had told me, you know, hey, why don't you let John fly this first leg? And I thought, well, okay. And then the captain said to me, the reason I did that was because I thought I smelled alcohol in your breath back there in operations. And he said, I didn't know what to do. We're 8,000 miles from any kind of authority. And he said, if I had canceled the flight, he said, I thought about it, and if anybody in British Airways operations or any of the flight attendants had said something about it, I would have canceled the flight, and your ass would have been in hot water. And so he said, just a word to the wise. And so I took it that, thought a lot about that, came home from that trip, had my last beer, Saturday night thing with my wife at a place called I can't think of the name of it. This is where Ritter's was, and then Ritter's closed down. Was it the Flamingo or something like that? The next morning, or Monday morning, I got a call from the chief pilot. He says, come on down. I want to have a talk with you. And it turns out that the captain of my flight started thinking about it. He said, you know, I stuck my arm out about that far for this guy. And one of the rules in the FAA is that you don't fly with anybody that's drunk, and you don't tolerate anybody that's drunk on your flight crew. If you do, you're just as guilty as the person. And so I think he was doing a cover your ass operation. He went to the chief pilot and said, I think Jim has a problem. So we argued about it a little bit, and I said, I'll quit. I'll go to AA and blah, blah, blah. And he says, no, I really think you want to have the chief pilot said, I think I want you to have an assessment. So I went to Anchor Hospital, which was Delta's choice, have an assessment, and sure enough, I passed. There I was, 28 days in Anchor Hospital. Boy, what a sense of shame I had. What a sense of shame. I was the lowest of the low. Actually, I wasn't the lowest of the low, because the guy I met there, when I checked into Anchor the next morning, the first thing they said to me is, Jim, I got somebody I want you to meet. And it was, a lot of you people know him, Lyle P. He wrote the story Grounded in the Big Book. He lives out in Covington, and he's a big speaker around these parts and around the country. Lyle P. had just been discharged from the prison system, where he had served a sentence for public endangerment. And he was working his way up. He had no job. He'd been fired by Northwest Airlines. He had been, terminated. His medical license and everything had been terminated by the FAA, so he was down and out. Long story short, Lyle retired 8 years after that from Northwest Airlines as a 747 captain, because he was an inspiration to everybody, and he was an inspiration and still is an inspiration to me. And from the get-go, I don't know if I've sorted it from Lyle or from who, but I just thought, okay, this is going to be all right. This is going to be all right. If you can't lick them, join them. And so I just kind of decided to be a model patient, or to try my best to be a model patient. And I impressed my therapist a lot. She actually hired me to do some work for her after I got my master's degree to be a therapist. But I just had no other choice but to try to say, well, if I've come to this low point, then I've got to make it mean something for the rest of my life. I learned that I'm not the center of the universe, for one thing. That was the first thing that occurred to me. And that had made things a hell of a lot easier. It was like I remember saying in one of my early AA meetings about, you'd drink too if you were in the center of the universe, if you're responsible for everything that went on. So that was a big relief. One of the first things I realized too was I got a conscience. Doing all those things that are not up to my ethical or moral standards weren't when I was a Boy Scout, and they still aren't. But I could sure turn a blind eye to them when I was under the influence of alcohol or when I was in my alcoholic world. They say that you hit your bottom when you can't lower your standards as fast as your world is going to shreds around you. And that was my case. What I started off with right away was going to meetings, going to every, meetings, meeting the requirement that I go to 90 and 90. That was an FAA-imposed restriction. And I was an overachiever. I did 119 and 90. I was disappointed I didn't get to 130, but it kept me sober for those 90 days. And for the next some time, it took me 5 months to get back in the cockpit, and I probably went to a daily meeting almost without fail during between March and September of 1992. But anyway, as soon as I could, you know, I started going to meetings. I started doing service work, you know, cleaning up after, making coffee, getting there early, not doing a lot of spectacular stuff, but just trying to be part of the program. As soon as I was off my monitoring period, I was on monitoring by the FAA for a couple of years. As soon as I got off that, I became instrumental in what we call the Delta Pilots Assistance Committee, the DPAC. And what the airlines have is a program where pilots, before 1972, pilots who were diagnosed as alcoholic, either by the medical forces or by the police, that was a permanent disqualification from flying an airplane. You couldn't have a medical license anymore, period. That drove a lot of people underground, obviously, and it drove a lot of people who were not alcoholics underground because they didn't want to ruin No Joe's career by calling him an alcoholic and outing him. So I joined the DPAC committee and got involved for the rest of my career at Delta, which was for another 9 years. I got sober in February 11th, 1992, and I retired September 30th, 2001. That was when I turned 60, which was the mandatory age then. But for that whole period, I worked on the DPAC committee, helping to monitor, being a peer monitor with pilots, going to educational seminars, contributing what I could to those seminars, and just trying to be involved in the program in that way. That was my professional outlet. At the same time, I was volunteering up at MAR, Metro Atlanta Recovery Residences, up in on the other side of town. What's that called over there? What is it? Doraville. Up in Doraville. In fact, the main reason I came to Ridgeview for my practicum and ended up here was because I live in East Cobb, and Doraville was just an impossible drive. And so when I put down my preference for my practicum, my internship, I put down Ridgeview because it was close. And I'm not sorry that I did, although I still love MAR and love the people out there. So I volunteered at MAR, I sat in on group meetings, I ran some 12-step meetings there during the 1990s and the early 2000s. Besides MAR, I decided in 2003 to go ahead and go to graduate school. I wanted to have some credentials. And there were a lot cheaper ways and easier ways to get credentialed than to get a master's degree. But I decided I was going to go ahead and get a master's degree. So I went to Argosy University. Scared the hell out of me because I hadn't been in school in a formal education since 1965. And so going back to graduate school in a master's program in 2003 was pretty scary. That was one of the things that my recovery did for me, was gave me the confidence to do that. And I was a straight A student in graduate school. Well, another thing that bouncing back a few years, that my confidence as a sober alcoholic was that I had the confidence to go ahead and upgrade from co-pilot to captain. And I spent the last 9 years of my career at Delta as first a 737 and then retired as a 767 captain. I'm pretty proud of that, and it's something that if I had not sobered up and had not killed myself or gotten fired because of my drinking, I might well have just not had the guts to do it. To do anything about it, and would have retired as a co-pilot, but I found out how rewarding it was to fly my own airplane, to be my own boss while I'm out there. So graduate school, church, coming to work at Ridgeview as a counselor, if I had not got sober when I did, this world would never have opened up to me. Holy cow. You know, when they say, talk about the promises coming true, geez, I've got so many good memories and good vibes about working, not just at Ridgeview, but in recovery as a whole, and associating with people in AA groups. I worked at Safety Net for a while, doing some family therapies, family counseling down there. But you know, I was just able to that's one of the promises that has come true for me. I just learned how to feel good by helping others and having the self-confidence to go ahead and do that. One of the things that I like to tell people about is that when I checked into Anchor Hospital, it was 2 days after I wrote a check to the Atlanta Braves for season tickets. This was after the 1991 worst of first season, and I remember sitting there thinking, boy, have I wasted a whole season, because I didn't know baseball without beer. I didn't know baseball without beer. And I was thinking, boy, I just blew that money. Little did I know that my higher power had a plan for me. And when I went and got into my seats the first season, the first game, home game, I sat down, there's a guy and his wife sitting next to me, and we introduced ourselves. And I don't think it was through the first half of that first game that he introduced himself as a member of this fellowship. He had several years sober, and his wife was a strict Al-Anon. And so with them on my left and my wife on my right, I was safe. I was safe. And I don't ever remember coming home from a game and wondering who won. I don't remember ever going to a game and having my wife say, where have you been all night? Wow. That's living, folks. That's really living. Another thing that I had the confidence to do in sobriety. I've always loved to sing. I've always loved to sing. I'm not a good singer. I can carry a tune in a bucket. I've got pretty good tone, but I don't have a vocal, solo vocalist voice, and I always thought that, well, that's what you need to sing. But when I went to West Point as a 19-year-old, I thought my biggest ambition was to be a member of the Glee Club. I just thought the sun rose and set on the West Point Glee Club. I'd seen them on Ed Sullivan's show. I'd seen them do different performances and stuff like that. It's a marvelous choral group. And I wanted to be in the West Point Glee Club. You know, I didn't even try out for it. I was too busy trying to survive, dysfunctionally survive the academic system. But when I had an opportunity to, I didn't do it. I didn't do it. Well, here's one of my favorite stories about recovery. I was in Salt Lake City in about 1996, it was, as a matter of fact, July 1996. And I know that because that's when the barbershop singers, the SPEBSQSA, the Barbershop Society of the United States, has their convention on the July 4th weekends. And I was in Salt Lake City, and I asked on a layover, and I asked the limo driver, I said, what's going on in town? He said, well, there's a bunch of crazy barbershoppers here. They're singing on every street corner and just having a hell of a good time, but they're not drinking any liquor. And I thought, oh, that's really cool. So I thought, well, I'm gonna go down and listen to those guys. So I walk down to the Pulp Palace, and I'm looking for the ticket booth, and there is no ticket booth. Finally, somebody says, well, the ticket booth is on the other side of that block over there. So I'm walking over there, and some young man walking along with a girl, he had other things in his mind. See, I said, do you know where the ticket booth is? He says, yeah, it's over there, but you want tickets? I said, yeah. He said, here, I've got a couple. And I said, do I owe you anything for them? He said, no, they're yours. I found out later, they don't sell tickets for the barbershop convention. You got to be a member. You got to be a member of the society. So anyway, I go to the Salt Palace, and I'm sitting in the nosebleed section. And I'm looking at these guys down on stage, and they're just singing away and having a good time. And if a voice had come out of the rafters, which it didn't, but if a voice had come out of the rafters and said, Jim, next year you're going to be on that stage, I would have said, you know, nah, that's not going to happen. It did happen. It just so happened a friend of mine at my church was a member of the barbershop chapter that calls them the Big Chicken Chorus. Barbershoppers sing not only in quartets, but also in choruses. Some of the big choruses are as much as 150. Some of the small choruses are 25 or 35, somewhere in there. So I'm singing, and I thought, well, he said, why don't you come down and sing with us? I said, well, where do you sing? He said, right over here at Temple, I forget the name of the temple, but it was right there near Indian Hills, near where I live. I thought you guys practiced out in West Cottomore. He said, no, we've been here for a few years. So I went there and decided to practice with him. And after I'd been practicing and had joined up and everything, they start saying, well, are you going to join us in Indianapolis? And I said, what do you mean join you in Indianapolis? He says, we finished seventh in the competition last year. And we are the Dixie District champions, and we are going to the national convention for the seventh year in a row. And I said, yep, I'm going to Indianapolis. And so I get out there with the Big Chicken Chorus, and by that name, you can guess that everybody was waiting for our shtick. And we went out and we performed for them and got I found out what it's like to stand on the stage to a standing ovation of 10,000 people, is basically what it amounts to. This was a gift of sobriety. Without my sobriety, I would not have been in that position. I wouldn't have had the nerve to try. I would have just let another opportunity go by. My life is full of missed opportunities, if you know, want to know what it was like. It's just... you know, abuse, missed opportunities. Bought a house in Florida. Don't know how I had the money to do that, but my wife and I bought a lot down near Destin, Florida, built a house down there, and I still managed for the last almost 20 years to make payments on it. Which I am able to do. One of my favorite groups, AA groups in the world, is down there, Dustin Busters. I don't know if you all have ever heard of that, but it's world famous Busters. I've got tons of friends down there because of my association with Alcoholics Anonymous and Dustin and that area of the world. You know, I ran for the board of my church, which I hadn't done since I got pissed off at them about in the back in the 1980s when I was still drinking. I decided to run for the board of my church, and they elected me, and not only that, they elected me to be one of the officers of the church for a couple of years for the last 2 years that I was on the board. I think my higher power put me there too, because I was in that position when we had a church fire. We were doing a rebuilding program, and the church caught fire right as we were finishing. And boom, I had to step up and perform. I did it. And that's all because of the gifts of sobriety. Uh, I don't have to take a drink. I've had some bad stuff happen. I've really had some hard times. I take the antidepressants. I've had some hard times in my sobriety. I don't agree with the worst. The worst day in my sobriety is better than the best day in my drinking days, because I had some fun back then. But no matter what's happened, no matter what has happened to me along the way, I haven't had to take a drink. And I remember being in the hospital down there. I'm about to finish, Eddie. I remember being in the hospital down there and saying to my group, I don't have a clue. I remember these words specifically. My words were, I don't have a clue how I'm going to give up drinking for the rest of my life. And my doctor, a guy named Rick Fite, said, you don't have to, Jim. And I said, oh, what's the trick? And he said, you only have to give up drinking today. I've been doing that for 31 years. And somehow, I've been given the gift, the grace, the gift of it just being wiped clean from my desires. I have no desire. I never anymore think about having a drink. Does that mean I'm not really an alcoholic? I don't know. It doesn't matter. And this is what I wanted to finish up today with. People, when I got sober, I said, you know, who, why, how did this happen to me? You know, what's the scientific reason for this? And blah, blah, blah. It doesn't matter. I don't care what makes you an alcoholic or if nothing makes you an alcoholic. The point is that you don't have to drink anymore if you don't want to drink anymore. And if you stop drinking just one day at a time, the drinking obsession will go away. It may take some hard, hard work, but it'll happen. Knowing why, the big question why, every time something horrible happens, and you know, from airline crashes to school shooting, everybody wants to know why. The why, sometimes it just doesn't matter. Just say, this is what it is, and this is what we got to do to fix it. And so I don't worry about the why anymore, or even if I'm really an alcoholic or just an obsessive compulsive who can't stop drinking or eating chocolate cake or whatever. There are some things that I just don't start because I know that I'm gonna finish what's there. I don't care if it's alcohol or sugar. If I start it, it's until it's gone, I'm gonna eat some. So why? Knowledge alone, and this says on the big chapter 30, page 39 of the big book. Knowledge alone will not keep any of us sober. It's not the knowledge about why. It's the behavior. It's the behavior. We cannot reason our way into sober thinking, into sober living. We can't think our way into sober living. We can live our way into sober thinking. And that's what I think I have tried to do mostly. Just finish with this. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask her in your morning meditations what you can do each day for the one who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order, but obviously you can't give what you haven't got. See to it that your own house is in order and great events will come to pass. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Clear away, admit your faults to God and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find, and we shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit. We will surely meet some of you as we trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. That's the code that I've been living by for 31 years. I think I'm going to keep doing it. Thanks.
Thank you, Jim. That was great. That was a powerful story. And there's a lot of hope in this room, so.